What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 111, Understanding Professional Development, recorded September 17th, 2014. Our special guest this week is Shannon Leftwich from the BOC Credentialing Office. She has been with the BOC for about 14 years, and she's the Director of Credentialing, whatever you just said, services. Yeah. I am your host, Jeremy Jackson, and with me today is...
Jose.
Adrian.
Shakira.
Go ahead, you can say hi, Dr. Yellen.
Dr. Josh Yellen.
Olivia. Jess.
And Jess. We've changed your name since last week. So you can join our conversation at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com using hashtag DSMB on Twitter. Shakira is monitoring the chat room. If you're registered to earn the CEUs for the webinar, then make sure you have to register and then take the course evaluation afterwards. So you can use the chat room on there to ask your questions of Ms. Leftwich while we're live with her now. The Ustream social feature Adrian's kind of looking at, and links to all those are on the website. So without much further ado, let's get to understanding the professional development.
What do you feel has been a weakness of our CEU system in the past?
Well, that's a very good question. I think probably the inability previously, or actually even currently, to find out if CE programs actually improve patient outcomes and patient care. So, which is actually one of the reasons why we've introduced this evidence-based practiced continuing education category. So that's probably what we would think as to be the biggest weakness, is whether or not ATs are actually taking what they are learning at these programs and using them on their patients.
And I think that's probably pretty consistent with other medical professions that you hear in medicine and nursing and PT and OT, that, you know, what does the evidence show? And so I'm glad you brought up this new CEU opportunity, evidence-based practice, right? So being an athletic trainer for, 15 years, whatever it is, you know, I hear a lot of my colleagues kind of griping about what is this new evidence-based and why do I need 10 hours? So can you expand a little bit more on that and why the EBP is so important?
Yeah, and it's probably not a lot different from what athletic trainers do already. You know, they go to programs, and to learn different things and to use best practices on their patients. So this new requirement is basically to encourage that and to encourage people to use best evidence on their patients instead of perhaps doing it the way they've always done it. Mm-hmm. So it ultimately is clinically relevant and is centered around patient care. So that's why the standards committee, and actually the standards committee of the Board of Certification, they make the recommendations for continuing education requirements to our board of directors, who ultimately approves them. But how this came about was an outside request of, hey, other healthcare professions are doing this. Shouldn't the BOC be looking at infusing evidence-based practice into their continuing education?
Mm-hmm. You asked about our target audience. Our target audience, is the BOC responsible for CEUs for any other group?
No, they are not. It's just, we just certify athletic trainers. I think when I asked about the target audience for a question, that you had indicated, I wasn't sure if I should be directing the response to BOC approved providers or to certified athletic trainers. So I think that's what I meant by that comment.
All right. So I guess kind of for both of them, and we'll talk about more about the requirements and some of the things that we're doing here and some of the changes that are coming up. But, a lot of athletic trainers are kind of running a CEU event. So, you know, like with the GHATS organization, that's all athletic trainers running events, or with the Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, that's pretty much all athletic trainers running those events. So, I mean, maybe I'm just sheltered or something, but in my opinion, they're both kind of the same. So,
yeah, and quite frankly, a lot of our providers, our approved provider programs, are not athletic trainers, because it's their business. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. They put on continuing education programs. So your smaller ones, such as yourself and your associations, districts, yes, those are going to be athletic trainers that are doing this.
So I have a question for you. This is Josh Allen. Right. So I'm at the University of Houston, and one of our goals is to become a BOC approved provider. Same way that when I was at Southeastern, I was a BOC approved provider. And I want to be able to apply to be able to do this. And I've got a couple different ideas. You know, maybe I'm going to use one of these new Biodex machines, or we're going to talk about concussions. So can you walk through the process for those that are interested in being an approved provider? What's the process that we need to be able to complete?
So it's an application process, the application is based on a program that you currently have or that you plan to have in the near future. And it asks things like, who is your target audience? And you'd be surprised, but we get applications that don't even include athletic trainers in their target audience. It asks for objectives. It asks for course outline. So what we, when we're looking at reviewing the application, what we're looking for is, okay, is it appropriate for athletic trainers? Does it fall within the domains of athletic training? Is it at or above entry level for athletic training? Do they follow all the guidelines in the guidebook for the most part, or have the ability to once they are approved? You know, do they have a cancellation refund policy if they charge a fee? So it's actually a fairly simple process to become a BOC approved provider. And that's the current process. So as you may or may not know, there are also some new standards that will be implemented in 2016. So all BOC approved providers will need to comply with the 2016 standards for that. And we are actually looking at different ways to assess whether or not a provider is complying with those standards. So nothing has been finalized as of yet. We're still in the planning stages of, are we going to have them submit an annual report? Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing.
As far as the BOC's, the application process, I would say it's relatively easy, because I know GHATS is actually the one that has the CEU provider number, but Jessica Roberts had called me and saying, hey, the sports medicine broadcast isn't meeting the requirements for CEU opportunities. And to fix it, it was relatively simple. And so I just had to look at what was required, because I hadn't done that. But, you know, it was just my fault before. I hadn't done that. So I looked at it, and it took me, I don't know, an hour to get the format correct. And, you know, in a couple different emails back and forth saying, okay, you know, I have this figured out. Does it meet the requirements? And then Jessica was like, yeah, you know, at this time, yes. But you need to look at the new 2016 standards, because I'm not sure if they do for those new standards. So, you know, make sure you want to move in that way. So I can speak to, yes, it is relatively simple.
And so obviously, Jeremy, you and I know, you know, where to access this, but can you elaborate a little bit, you know, for people that are listening and says, hey, look, you know, I may want to be a BOC provider and I want to access those 2016 standards. Where would they go to go find that?
Right now, it was published in the Approved Provider Update, mm-hmm. Which is a newsletter just for providers. And that was sent in their April or spring issue, I guess it was. And it will also be posted on our website. I don't know that it's posted just yet. I know that they're working on it, on getting it posted.
Okay. Olivia, do you have a question?
Discuss some of the new requirements for CEU events in 2016 and why those changes were made.
Okay. So what the standards committee, because again, the standards committee is the group that developed these. What they were trying to do is raise the bar for athletic trainers and get that high quality programming for ATs for their professional development. Right now, we don't have standards for continuing education providers. We have some guidelines, like, you know, you have to give a certificate, you have to keep a roster, you know, simple business practices is pretty much what they're limited to. This goes a step and a half further in telling them that, okay, you need to take a look at your administration and your business practices and the content and how you're developing your programs and, you know, are your instructors qualified, requiring an assessment and letting the consumer or the participant to reflect on and take back to their practice what they have learned. So it's just taking that next step for providers. And really, you know, when you asked this question, that's why I asked, okay, who am I talking to? Am I talking to providers or am I talking to athletic trainers? Because really the answer is different. Mm-hmm. For athletic trainers, you're not going to see any changes that you have to make, but you will see, hopefully, some improvements on continuing education programs. For the providers are the ones that are going to need to be more accountable for their programs.
So it sounds like you guys are really trying to align, you know, the process with exactly what we see in academic institutions, right? So as a director of a program, I have got to have a academic assessment plan, and I've got to be able to evaluate that plan, and I've got to have a place where students can be evaluated and faculty can be evaluated. And we take this overall plan, and I'm watching Jeremy kind of scroll through some things, and he pulled up a diagram of Bloom's taxonomy. And so having this whole process fit into that sounds like that's the direction that the BOC is going. Is that correct?
Yeah, it really is. You know, when you take a look at some of the objectives, you know, in today's programming, some are really great and mm-hmm. some are not so great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, using Bloom's taxonomy best practice in writing objectives and purpose statements for programs, it's, you know, it's our hope that, okay, if people can see what the program is going to be about a little bit more clearly, that can indicate, okay, yes, I have a need for this program. So it's, again, you know, just kind of raising the bar for providers and making them more accountable for their programming.
And so just out of curiosity, if somebody wants to learn more about this education process, right? Because as you know, as a program director, we make up, I think it's like less than 1% of the entire athletic training population. And so the program directors and the faculty and the clinical coordinators, they know about this Bloom's taxonomy. They know about academic assessment plans. For people that are outside of that network and maybe are, you know, you're at a Memorial Hermann or a GHATS or a sports medicine broadcast, and you want to get some more training on measurable outcomes, academic assessment plans, Bloom's taxonomy, will the BOC be offering any courses in that?
Yeah, we're looking at, we're creating about a 3-year plan right now that will include educating approved providers. Mm-hmm. We already have several resources for providers to use that will be posted, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, I would imagine, because they are completed documents. We're just, you know, making them pretty and need to get them up on the website. So, you know, we already have some resources for the evidence-based practice category for those applicants or for those providers that are submitting applications. But we have several resources that we have created to help providers comply with the new standards. And those resources really came from the providers in their comments during the public comment feedback period that we had prior to finalizing the 2016 standards.
And can you go back to a statement you said earlier, right? The request, you know, for all of this really came from an outside source. So can you elaborate on who that outside source was? Was that?
Well, it actually came from the education, what is it now? The education, The ECE of the NATA. Okay. They keep changing their acronyms.
The Executive Education Committee.
Executive Council on Education.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Or is it committee now?
I don't. You know what? I don't know.
Either way.
I know it has to do with executive and education.
Yes. So it actually came from that group. The original request.
And are all these standards more in line with what other allied healthcare professions are doing for their CEUs, or is this something that athletic training is taking on their own and creating their own standards?
No, this is certainly, we didn't recreate the wheel, if you will. Other healthcare professions do have standards for their providers. So we did, that's always one of the very first things that we do when we start researching what are other healthcare professions doing. So, we looked at the standards that the PTs have for their continuing education that was developed by the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy. We looked at what the occupational therapists had, what the pharmacists had, what the dietitians had, so, you know, the nurses. Mm-hmm. So we looked at all of those, and quite frankly, you know, again, we didn't want to recreate the wheel, so, we don't like to use the word stole, but we used.
Well, I mean, I'm gonna replace your word stole and use the word benchmark. You benchmark yourself against other professions, and what you're doing is you're providing an avenue for athletic training to increase, you know, its equity stake in the healthcare model. That's what we're trying
to
do. Right,
and that's really what it's, you know, what we're trying to get. Us moving to is we are healthcare providers as athletic trainers, and we need other people to start recognizing that. Unfortunately, that includes other athletic trainers. Right. But yes, we are healthcare providers. We need to start, doing our professional development as such. We need to start practicing as such.
Well, and we see this debate, you know, back and forth. So, you know, as we're putting together this new program at the University of Houston, and, you know, Katie has their standards and the BOC has their standards and the NATA has their standards. And so, you know, as the program, we need to be able to take all of these different standards and say, look, this is how we're going to practice. And this is the highest ethical standard that we can practice at. And we're going to hold everybody accountable for that. And you have some people that say, well, you know, for X amount of years, I've done it this way or X amount of years, I've done it that way. And I understand that. But just like everything else, you know, this has to change, and we're going to improve out of this. So, you know, we're increasing accountability, we're increasing visibility, and any time you do that, you're going to face more scrutiny out of that.
Right. So, when you said that, it kind of sparked, we get a lot of questions about the evidence-based practice, and some people, it's not as bad as I probably thought it was going to be, but... we get some people that think, oh, well, now I have to go out and research. Well, no, that's not what you have to do. That's what these presentations have done for you. They've gathered the evidence for you. They're presenting it to you. So, that seems to be kind of a misnomer, is that, now I got to go, you know, I have to go do the research myself. Well, no, that's not it at all.
No, but, you know, you need to be able to understand what the research is saying. You know, the example I always give to other athletic trainers is, you know, why do I need to do this evidence-based practice? And the example I always give is say, okay, well, let's say you go to your physician and, you know, you need to be placed on this medicine. And, you know, the physician needs to be able to weigh what are the indications, what are the contraindications, and what does the evidence say? And so is this based on the best evidence? Is this going to be the best direction for you to take as a patient? And so the athletic trainers need to be able to interpret that data, right? So if you're going to apply a modality or a rehab technique or you know, make some recommendations, you need to be able to go back and say, okay, what does the evidence say? Right. And not necessarily conducting your own original research, but being able to interpret what other people have done.
Right.
And that's what that's about. Know,
also encouraging people to, you know, read the journals and what's out there.
Yeah.
You know, because that really is a great resource. You know,
the journal. I like how you emphasize the word read. You know, well. Read. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's out there for everyone to see. It's just a matter of, okay, we're really encouraging you to do this because we really think that it's going to have better outcomes for your patients and improve your patient care.
So since we're kind of on evidence-based practice, you know, ideally I would like to be able to use the sports medicine broadcast for that. And I know currently it has to be, each episode has to be approved beforehand. But if I was wanting to do this, I mean, you know, we're talking about reading research. So would it be something where I brought in, you know, Dr. Yellen, and he's been doing research on athletic training education or master's athletic training program, and you know, we're discussing that. Does that meet those qualifications?
Well, it depends. You know, you have to follow the basic principles of evidence-based medicine. You know, so there has to be a clinical question, mm-hmm. and you know, your objectives need to be clearly stated, and your you know, you not have to be assessing what you have just learned. So, you know, absolutely, I think it certainly can be done. It's just a matter of being able to complete the evidence-based practice application, which really isn't that difficult. I mean, if you know what a clinical question is and you know how to write one, that's really the half the battle.
Right.
So,
it's like anybody that's gone on and done a master's thesis or a doctoral dissertation, you need to be able to ask the right question and come up with the format to answer it.
Right. And we have we have resources on how to write a clinical question. We have resources on how to develop good objectives. You know, so, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to help the providers develop an application and a program, you know, because there are some providers that really want to get into this evidence-based practice thing, and that's what we want.
Oh, yeah.
You know, ideally, we would not like to have this category anymore.
Right.
You know, it's just that's what all providers are doing is basing their programs on evidence. So,
well, I'm
going to
call
eventually
out two people. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's our hope that eventually this category won't even exist.
Yeah, I'm going to call out two people that are associated with the University of Houston. One is, of course, is Dr. Mark Knobloch, and I'm fairly confident that he's listening right now. So Dr. Knobloch is my clinical coordinator over at UH, and he's teaching our research and athletic training class to our master of athletic training students. And the other one is Dr. Lane Bailey. Dr. Bailey is the director of research for Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. So along those ways, I bet you we can put those two in a room together and let them come up with a couple different options. And then maybe we can present this to the BOC and get approved in the evidence-based category.
Hello.
Yep.
Hello.
I lost ya.
Okay, so I don't know if you want to repeat that.
Oh.
Because when you heard that, whoop.
Oh, that was it. She dropped off.
Yeah,
not sure what happened.
That, yeah, people, you know, they get so flustered by evidence-based, they just disconnect, you know. Yeah.
So you're just so overpowering.
Yeah, that's it. So what I was saying was that, you know, Dr. Mark Knobloch at the University of Houston, he's our clinical coordinator. He's teaching our research and athletic training class for our Master of Athletic Training students. And we also are affiliated with Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. And so the director of their research is Dr. Lane Bailey, and he's a doctoral prepared, you know, PT. So what I'd like to do is get Dr. Knobloch and Dr. Bailey in the same room and kind of lock them in there and see what they can come up with in this evidence-based category. And then once we can get that, I think, nailed down, we can probably submit it to the BOC and be pretty successful. And, you know, sports medicine broadcast can benefit from that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And then that would go into, you know, of course, our plan for taking over the world. So
exactly.
That's, yeah, that's right in there. Well, and then we would have the evidence to prove it. So
that'll work.
Yeah.
What can we do on the sports medicine broadcast to ensure we are meeting the needs of athletic trainers?
I think, you know, as long as you're being consistent with your programming as far as, you know, the quality, you know, I think letting everybody know, you know, what the topic's about. My biggest frustration when I go to a conference is I look at the title, and even sometimes the course description, and when I get there, it's something completely different. So, you know, I think it's important to have clearly stated objectives and just to be, you know, be consistent and make sure that they, you know, have the opportunity to reflect on what, you know, what they just heard and to, you know, also consider different people's learning styles. Mm-hmm. You know, the adult learning theory, that mm-hmm. certainly needs to be taken into consideration. So, you know, just being consistent and being considerate of your audience and what their needs are. And, you know, it's our hope that for the BOC to help our providers determine what kind of topics athletic trainers are looking for. You know, we don't have a mechanism right now to really do that, but, you know, our hope is that we could, with future projects that we've got going on, that we're able to say, okay, what are your professional development needs? And, you know, what's out there? And if there's nothing out there, we can reach out to providers and say, hey, have you considered doing a program on this? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think, you know, providers can help themselves too by, you know, just taking a poll of athletic trainers and seeing what they need. But I think too that athletic trainers need to also be more accountable for their professional development. Mm-hmm. And I know that sometimes people get stuck in a rut and they just attend things just to attend them. And we really want to encourage people to attend things that, you know, that they really need. You know, perhaps there's a gap in their knowledge and skills, you know, that may be identified. We have a professional development needs assessment available for free on our website. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how many people are aware of it. I mean, we've put it in every issue of our cert update since it's been available, which is a couple of years
and
now.
So do you need to be a certified athletic trainer to take that? Like, for instance, if I'm...
No.
You mm-hmm. know, our master's degree is 2 years, and so at the end of that 2 years, I'd like these students to be able to take that and find
out. Yeah, no, you know. Absolutely. It was actually created for athletic trainers and students.
Great.
So, and there's, you know, you can, we have an abbreviated version. We'll get this, we'll give you reflection at the domain level. Mm-hmm. But we also have a lengthy version, which goes through every single knowledge and skill statement in the role delineation study practice analysis. That it takes a little bit longer, but you get feedback at the task level.
Right.
And then we also have it by domain. So if you've taken it once and you've, you know, maybe gone out and have tried to do some things and you just want to know how you're doing in domain one, you can do that so that you don't have to take the whole thing over again. So, you know, it's another tool that we really encourage athletic trainers to use and to kind of guide their professional development. But it's not only on your, you know, gap analysis, but also, you know, what are your future goals as for your profession,
right,
or your career. So,
yeah, we have a lot of people that start in one area and, you know, something catches their attention and they want to move into another.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In order to do that, you need to be specifically trained to do that, right? So as athletic training develops, over the 20 something years that I've been a part of it, from student to where I am now, you know, I've seen athletic training really, you know, explode, especially over the last 5 or 10 years, where traditionally you saw athletic trainers in, you know, sports settings, really, you know, sports medicine clinics, outreach clinics, universities, high schools, professional sports. And now all of a sudden, like, I work with two of the athletic trainers at NASA, And, you know, there's an athletic trainer, Webb Miranda, that is at United Airlines. And mm-hmm. some athletic trainers are with the, you know, the military and police departments and fire departments and physician extenders. And so from an educator standpoint, really kind of looking at almost these residency models that everybody's coming out, you know, they all understand the practice domains and they all understand the educational competencies. And any educator would understand that BOC crosswalk and prepare your students to take the BOC and pass it. But then after they graduate, right, they want to be able to focus on these areas. So along the same lines of what we've been talking about, if we follow that medical model, maybe to be proactive and create some of these residency programs, like if somebody wants to be a physician extender or they want to go more occupational medicine or they want to go, you know, I've seen some courses for athletic trainers like in combat medicine or, you know, these other areas. Are those avenues that the BOC is looking at?
Well, actually, I know that the NATA is looking at different kinds of certificate programs and specialty certification programs. So I know that Post-Professional Education Committee, which is under the ECE, mm-hmm. they're looking at different things like that. So is the Professional Development Committee, the PDC of the ECE. They're looking at that. So you know, I know that there are many things going on at the NATA as far as looking at, you know, do we need to move in that direction of, you know, educating or providing education to allow somebody to specialize.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Are there some more students that want to ask questions here?
Well, the next one I have is actually for me.
Okay.
Because I didn't know if we were going to have time, and they're going to be leaving here in about 2 minutes, I think. But we've kind of talked about the EBP and how it has to be submitted. But ideally, what we would like to do is to have the webinar be popular enough to where we charge for that, so that it can fund the fee. I think it's $50 for the home study course. So as I prepare to do that, I mean, obviously, if I'm doing the webinar that counts for CEUs, I would just think, well, then obviously, if the webinar is counting for CEUs, then the home study podcast would be as well, as long as I have the back end stuff. Whereas, you know, they have to have the quiz and that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit more about how I can make that transition?
Yeah. So right now, home studies are approved on an individual basis, whereas live events, those are covered under your approved provider umbrella, if you will, as long as it falls within the domains and it's for athletic trainers. So with home studies, we actually look at those individually. We used to have a lengthier review process in that it was somewhat peer-reviewed, and that was primarily because we needed help determining the number of CEUs. Well, most of our home studies that come in are based on a video anymore, or a podcast, or something that is a definite time. You know, if it's a 1 hour video, it'll be one CEU. The issue that we always had is with the ones that were text-based, because everyone reads at a different rate, everyone comprehends at a different rate. So, and we've actually gone to a formula for text-based. So we no longer review them with other athletic trainers. The process was entirely too lengthy. When you're depending on volunteers, and we love our volunteers, sometimes they just don't have time to look at them. So they would get caught up in the system. So now we do them all in-house, and we use the formula for text-based. If it's, you know, a video or something like that, we use the 1 = 1, one contact hour equals one CEU. So, you know, it's just another, the application is fairly short. Again, I believe it asks for objectives and a course outline and things of that nature. Those then get their own approved provider number and so are listed as a BOC approved home study.
So the home study in general, like, so if I was using the sports medicine broadcast, so there would be a approved provider number for the webinars and then a one for each episode of the podcast, or one for the home study in general?
One for the home study. So what is your provider number now? Let's say it's
3136,
P,
but I'm not sure.
Okay. P3136. Your first approved home study would be P3136-1.
Gotcha.
So that would, you would then have to put on your certificate that provider number with the dash one for those that complete the home study version.
Now, let me ask you another question. As far as, you know, fees, generating fees, if a provider wants to charge, you know, athletic trainers, you know, like for instance, I'm going back to the University of Houston. So let's say we take our affiliates and our collaborators and we say, okay, we're going to put something together that is for AT, PT, OT, and strength coach, right? And we want to charge for something like that. Does the BOC, how does that work? How does collaborating, I guess it's two separate questions. How does collaborating with other, I guess, credentialing bodies work? And then how does, you know, if we want to be able to make, you know, charge some fees for the sports medicine broadcast or charge some fees for the MAT program, what does the BOC think about that?
BOC has no issues with providers charging fees for their programs. As far as like co-sponsoring, is that what you
are kind of sure.
getting at? You know, that's not an issue either, as long as all the paperwork goes through your provider number. So your contact person is, you know, has the roster on file, mm-hmm. does the certificates, you know, that sort of thing. Okay. So we don't have an issue with co-sponsoring. Now, in the 2016 standards, you will notice that there is, that you'll want to pay close attention. It's, let's say if you want to do a program about, let's say, a new machine, mm-hmm. A new piece of equipment, a modality, and the co-sponsor is perhaps the maker of that modality, mm-hmm. that may be seen as a conflict. So, you know, those kinds of things that in the when it comes to 2016, you'll want to kind of pay attention to as far as that, because we do have some language in there so that, you know, commercially we're not getting into conflicts there.
I understand. And I mean, I suppose that's in line with, you know, what other professional organizations do. You know, if I go see a talk on concussions, more than likely the neuropsychologist or whoever's speaking is going to get up there and say, you know, I've identified any conflicts that I may have, and, you know, it's transparent in nature, and, you know, there's no hidden agenda here. So I think that's a good move.
Yeah, you know, and obviously we don't want them, you know, selling impact, you know, in their presentation. Sure. So,
sure. Totally understand. Now, before we got started, can you go back, just if anybody's listening, because you go back and forth and you say, you know, us as athletic trainers and we. So I'm assuming, Shannon, that you're an athletic trainer.
I am. I've been certified since 1997.
Uh-huh.
I was a GA at Tennessee Tech University and then an intern, and then I was the assistant at Nebraska Wesleyan University. And then I was offered this job. So, and actually I was offered two jobs at the time. One was working outreach to a high school, and and then this job. And it was like, what do I do? And I was super young. And I just decided this one may never come up again. So I better take my chances on this one. And well, 14 years later.
It's worked out pretty well.
It's worked out all right.
And so, you know, it's a really interesting transition, right? So as an athletic trainer on the education side, speaking to an athletic trainer on the clinical side, a lot of time those worlds don't cross. And right. So can you talk a little bit about, to the audience, some of the things that you've learned along the way of, you know, here you were just like all of us, you know, you're on the clinical side and then you kind of move into this education side. Some of the things that you've learned along the way.
Well, that sometimes you have to take off your athletic trainer hat. Mm-hmm. That was really, really hard to do in the beginning. and look at things from a credentialing aspect. I mean, we have standards that we have to follow ourselves to keep our accreditation. So there's reasons, there's methods to our madness, and there's reasons to the things that we do. So, you know, while I may have, I have to follow the standards of professional practice for athletic training, I also need to, you know, wear that other hat of a credentialing agency that says, okay, here are the standards that you guys need to follow.
Right.
So that's been difficult. And the fact that, you know, I literally have not practiced in 14 years.
Right.
So do I even deserve to put ATC behind my name? I don't know.
Well, I mean, if I were to go along the lines with other medical professionals, let's say you, you know, you have a physician that's earned the right to have those initials after their name, but they've gone into administration.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, and that's, you know, the difference between a voluntary credential and an academic credential.
Right.
You know, no one can ever take MD away from you.
Right.
Whereas ATC can be taken away from you.
Right.
So, you know, that's the difference there. Like, you know, my Master's of Arts, no one's ever going to take the MA away from me. But you need to earn and continue to earn the ATC credential.
And what did you get your master's in?
Mine was actually in health and human health and performance, I believe it was. It's been a while.
And did you, so like for me, you know, I got my bachelor's at Cal State Northridge in 99, and then I got my master's in 04 from Long Beach State, bachelor's in athletic training, you know, master's in kinesiology, where I did like a subspecialty in sports medicine. And then I got into the academic side of things, and I realized I was deficient in some of these, you know, these KSAs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I went on and I got my EDD in educational leadership. And so going along the line, do you envision there are going to be more opportunities for athletic trainers to pursue advanced degrees, advanced education in the areas that they're interested in? So for instance, right now you've got, you know, somebody can go get their PhD or an EDD, or, you know, they can go and get a DA. I've seen that a couple times. And now some of these DAT degrees are popping up, where these so I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that you may see it more often. I you know, obviously the educators, they have a completely different role than as a clinician. So, you know, an EDD makes sense, or even a PhD, depending on the program, mm-hmm. makes sense for them to roll into. But yes, yeah, you're right. You're now seeing, you know, I think it's Rocky Mountain University or something of that nature. They have a DSC, Doctor of Science, that is athletic training driven. So, you know, I think you're going to see more of it. But I also think that you're going to see smaller things than somebody going to get a doctorate. I think you're going to see some specialty certifications. So, you know,
that's good. That's always so positive.
Perhaps. Yeah. I think, you know, manual therapy may be one, specialty in, being a physician extender.
Right.
So I think, you know, not only by, practice setting, but also by the role in which you play are going to be factors in those things. So
now can we weigh in on the topic of the decade, right? The transition of undergraduate athletic training degree to an entry level master's degree. What do you know, and it's funny, you know, everybody laughs about it, but I'm one of those educators that made that transition, right? So I was mm-hmm. I got my bachelor's in athletic training and my master's in a related field, but when I first started on, you know, this journey, you know, I got interested in the academic side, and I was a part of, you know, I was an instructor and I was a clinical coordinator, and then I was a program director for an undergraduate athletic training program. And then this entry-level master's degree opportunity came up. And, you know, I was at a conference probably 5 or 6 years ago. It was at CETA, and I heard one of the speakers weigh in on, I bet we're going to start to see more of these entry-level master's degrees pop up. And for a lot of the reasons that the NATA, the board of directors, released, you know, there's 11 key findings. And it seemed like that person was, you know, far ahead of their time in saying that. And I also remember a lot of people just almost booed them right off the stage. And here we are. And right. So, I mean, what's your feel on this, right? So you're on the credentialing side, and you have a what I would call a 30,000 foot view. And so what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I have no idea what they're going to decide. Right. And it's not a BOC decision. It's ultimately going to be a KD decision.
Right.
You know, but if you look at the evolution of athletic training, I mean, we kind of had a similar discussion when we got rid of the internship route.
Right.
That was a big deal, and I'm an internship route product.
Right.
So, you know, is it the appropriate evolution to go from, you know, to have the master's be entry level? I don't know. I don't know if that's the right step or not. But it's certainly, you know, I think the first time it was announced that the internship route was going to be eliminated, it was 1997.
Armageddon. Armageddon was upon us.
And then, you know, it was in 1997. And then in 2003 was the last
right.
year for internship candidates.
Right.
So, you know, we're not quite 20 years down the road.
Right.
Perhaps it is. But I really think you have to look at the evidence. And I know that the ECE is doing their best to collect additional evidence than what they already have. So, you know, I'd be interested to see what an economist would say. How is it going to help or hinder the profession? Or even public protection, you know, because that's where our view comes from.
Right.
Is it going to protect the public? Is it going to create an access problem?
Right.
You know, and that's what state regulators are interested in as well, is, okay, if you change this, will there be an access issue? I have spoken with one regulator that I speak with often, and he thinks, no, it's not going to be an issue at all if they were to jump to this. You know, so I think that there's more information that we need to find out, and I know that everybody wants to make the decision best on, you know, the evidence that
right.
we have.
I think that we're following, you know, again, going back to one of the statements you said, we're not recreating the wheel. You know, we're following some other like professions. And if we look at the evolution of PT and OT, you know, they've moved in this direction where you went from an undergraduate degree to a graduate degree. And ultimately, you know, you're finding more mature students, and you're finding students that are more focused on their particular curriculum. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned pretty quickly moving from the undergraduate to the graduate degree was, this last summer I taught anatomy, and the questioning that I got in the class was far more superior, obviously, to an undergraduate student, because they had already seen this information in their undergraduate degree. They had time to process this. They had time to reflect on this, you know, going back to that Bloom's taxonomy. So when we got back to the anatomy class, and, you know, we're working with cadavers, their questioning was at a higher order. And I equate that to, okay, if you're able to assimilate this knowledge and you're able to understand it better, when you get to be a clinician, you're going to understand it that much more. So hopefully what that equates to, or what that translates to, is you're going to provide better patient care because you understand it at a deeper level and you understand these different issues. You know, I think it's really a really interesting time. I'm a little disappointed in some of the athletic trainers because they've made this, you know, almost a personal battle.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and I don't think that does well for the entire profession. You know, we need to be able to move forward as a cohesive group. And I look at little signs like, for instance, you know, Dr. Cuppet, who is the executive director of Katie, and she came out of South Florida, and South Florida is moving to an entry-level master's degree. So, you know, or I look at Dr. Sowers, who's the director at AT Steele University, and they just came out with a new DAT program. So I look at little signs of what's happening and saying, you know, I can imagine a time, you know, in the not too distant future where the entry level requirement is a master's degree and you'll be taking in students that have, you know, extra science degrees and kinesiology degrees and, you know, whatever you want to call it. And the entry level requirement is a master's. And then for post-professional education, you'd go on for something like a DSC or a DAT, or you'd go on for a certificate program that would allow you to specialize in these different areas.
I'll jump in for a second. You said the last internship testing for the BOC or for the ATC was in 2004, right?
Well, the last time somebody could apply through that route was in 2004.
Yeah, and that's when I graduated.
We probably still have people taking the exam that went through that route.
Awesome. So that's when I graduated, was in 2004, and I went through the internship at HBU, and I feel that I definitely missed out. I mean, as a freshman, they said, all right, go out to baseball practice. All right, you're traveling with baseball. But there was never any sort of formal education. And I think that's why it's taken me until I was, you know, almost 30 to really say, hey, this professional development stuff is really going to help me be better. You know, it's taken me a while to really embrace what I'm doing and learning to get better, is because I was never taught to look at evidence. I was never taught to take what other people are doing and, you know, make my practice better. So I think as far as the professional development, one of the biggest things that helped me was Twitter, because I'm constantly interacting with other athletic trainers and saying, oh, hey, you know, I can do better here. Or, you know, we've talked to Steve Kennelly from the New York Giants, and then Josh Stone. Both of them are on, you know, one side or the other of the fence about ice, and you're hearing, you know, evidence and opinions on both sides. But those things I wouldn't have thought about never using ice until somebody said it. And so I think Twitter's helped me a lot, but I'm honestly glad that the NATA went away from the internship route, because I don't think it really prepared me to do what I had to do.
Yeah, I mean, I as an internship product, I appreciate all the experiences that I had. And, right. You know, I think the requirement was 1,500 hours under the supervision of an athletic trainer. And I think I had, like, I don't know, 4,000.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, they really kind of threw you to the wolves a little bit. But also, those programs were the ones that were really, really shorthanded.
Right.
You know, I think our the head athletic trainer was part-time. You know, now I look at it and I think they have, I don't know, four full-time athletic trainers doing the job of what essentially one man did.
Right.
So, you know, times have changed, and I think for the better, right. Quite frankly. So,
you know, and I look at it from a public perception. You know, I was watching the show The Shark Tank the other day, right, where if anybody's, yeah, me too. And as a matter of fact, I'm thinking about writing an article and submitting it to the NATA News about it. About, you know, I was watching The Shark Tank the other day, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, Jeremy, but, you know, it's where an entrepreneur stands in front of these, you know, so you're familiar with, right, four or five investors. And really what they do is that they talk about their product and they sell their product. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to get these investors to buy into what you're doing. And they talk about, you know, valuation, and they talk about equity stake, and they talk about certain percentages that they want to own or not own or license or all these different things. And so what that did is that started to get me thinking about athletic training. And so here's an opportunity where if I replace those sharks with the public, right, and I put the investor and I put an athletic trainer in that investor, there are certain questions that I would ask. You know, geez, how do you stack up against some of these other like professions? What can you do? What can't you do? And why? What's your education compared to these other like professions? What's your credentialing process? What experiences did you have to prepare you to be in these fields? And I would agree with you, Shannon, that, you know, as we keep on moving forward in this education model and the education debate, that only positive things are going to come out, because ultimately what it does is that it really shines a light on the education and the value of an athletic trainer. It shines a light on, you know, the athletic trainer is a legitimate healthcare provider in the medical model. If I look at other like professions, If I'm not mistaken, we're the only medical profession that specializes in, or at least we have a domain and educational competencies in, the prevention of injury. And we're the only medical profession that can specialize in not only that prevention of injury, but we combine it with the immediate care of that injury. So we're a very valuable model, especially in this new healthcare model where there's so much emphasis and focus on prevention now. And, you know, as we keep moving and as we get more strict on our licensing requirements and our educational processes, and Katie becomes more focused on their accrediting processes and the BOC and the NATA, and everybody starts working together, I think that just helps us. So, you know, like I said, if we go back and we look at athletic training like the Shark Tank, you know, if I'm an athletic trainer, I want to make sure that I can compete with these other like professions and ultimately let the public decide, you know, which direction they want to go. And we've seen this debate before, and we've seen these arguments, whether it was, you know, MD or DO, whether it's, you know, do I go to an ophthalmologist or an optometrist? Do I go to, you know, a podiatrist or an orthopedist? And let the public decide on what they want. But in order for us to have that seat at the table, we need to make sure that we're able to justify our existence and justify it well. And you do that by education.
Absolutely.
So I'm off my soapbox now. That's yeah. Well, I don't think I have a whole lot more, any questions for you, Shannon. I really appreciate it. I think from a professional standpoint, I'm really happy that you're there. And I'm happy that you're able to answer some of these questions. And I think after having a conversation with you, I'll probably be emailing you more, asking you some more questions.
Well, that's what we're here for.
That's good. Thank you very much for everything you're doing for us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And, you know, if any providers out there have any questions, you know, they can contact me or Jessica Roberts in her office. That's pretty much all she does all day long and stuff for the approved provider. So.
Can you give us your email or your contact information?
Sure. Do you want me to say it now?
Yep.
Okay. It's Shannon L, S-H-A-N-N-O-N-L, at bocatc.org.
Great. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting us.
All right. Well, so Shannon, if you want, you can hang up, and then I'll just close it out here on my end. So,
okay. Thanks. Sounds great.
Bye, Shannon. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Jeremy, this was a lot of fun, man. I love talking about this. You know, if Dr. Knobloch is listening, you know, this is when his eyes roll back in his head, is when we start talking about this. You know, he likes to get into, you know, myopathies. He likes to get into muscle physiology. He loves the evidence side. But what really gets me going, man, what really lights my fire is the education side. Because ultimately, the way I look at it is this, right? 41,000 athletic trainers in the country. And if we talk about the number of programs that are in the country, 300 and something, what that means is that, you know, we represent, as athletic training educators, we represent less than 1% of the entire athletic training population. And so if we're less than that 1%, so let's say that we, you know, let's just say mathematically we are 1%. That 1% is responsible for the other 99. So we want to make sure that we're getting it right. We want to make sure that we can produce a good product. We want to make sure that when these athletic training students, they graduate and they get a degree and they pass their boards and they get out to practice, they're going to be successful in society. And then they can come back and say, look at everything I did as an athletic trainer. And that only enhances our ability to compete with these other areas, right? And go back to the Shark Tank model. This, you know, we're not telling you that you only have to buy a Ford or a Chevy or a Dodge. We're giving you the option. We're giving the public the option. But in order to play that game, we got to make sure that we're dotting all of our I's and crossing all of our T's.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's funny that we were talking about the education and, you know, some of your students that come to you are licensed athletic trainers, mm-hmm. but most of them are not. And so one of the things, a conversation I've had with different people is the title student athletic trainer here in mm-hmm. high school. Because to me, you know, they say student aids, but my students don't just aid me. And a clinic, somebody in the clinic aids the, you know, that's a clinic aid. But for me, these are students that I'm training in CPR, that I'm teaching how to look at an injury. I'm teaching about anatomy. I'm teaching rehab. They know how to look at heat injuries. They know how to look for concussions. So these students that I'm working hard to prepare to be athletic trainers to send eventually to you, like, in my opinion, this is how I'm professionally preparing them and me at the same time. And I don't know. It is, I don't think it's something that I'm like militant about, mm-hmm. but it is something that like I'm intentional. I use student athletic trainer because, you know, for the most part down here in Texas, that's what we use. But I don't think that they're aides. I think they're more than just aides. They're not just somebody that's aiding me. They are a student athletic trainer.
So I adamantly disagree with you.
Okay, that's okay.
We can come back and talk about this, you know, another time if you want, because I can go on. I can go about 2 hours in depth.
We'll talk about that kind of at another time. But, yeah. but in my opinion, like,
and just, we'll shut that down and move on.
Just as professional development, I think it helps develop them and kind of set the standard. But again, we'll talk about that at some other time, and I'll get somebody else on my side, and you can get somebody else on your side. And
that's fine. And I'll take on the entire world. I'll stand up there. But yeah, let's schedule another time, because I think it's. You know, I think it's great, right? And I've seen it in California. I've seen it in Louisiana. I've seen it in other, right? So it's not just unique to Texas, where you've got these students at a high school that are interested in something along, you know, in the sports medicine field, right? So maybe I want to be an athletic trainer, maybe a PT, maybe an OT, maybe a chiropractor, maybe a physician, you know, who knows, maybe a strength coach. But I have an entry point, and that entry point is, you know, through a program that you have here at Pasadena High School. And so, you know, but what I think it comes down to the education, right? And I think it comes down to protecting the brand, right, of an athletic trainer. And to say that, you know, geez, this is a, you know, this is a student athletic trainer, right? So the public perception of that is, well, wait a minute, if you're a student athletic trainer, I see these other athletic training programs at colleges. And if I say, and I'm sure in Texas, I'm going to get oranges and tomatoes thrown at me if I say this, but you know, Texas is the only state, and I understand the history behind it. Texas is the only state in the country where you have, you know, two practice standards for athletic trainers, right? You've got the state license, and then you've got the national certification. And going back to what Shannon was talking about, if you were certified 2004 after, you don't take the state exam, certified 2003 or before like me, you take the state exam. And what that says to me is that, you know, at some point, and the history behind it, for those that don't understand, the history behind it is that the state of Texas had state regulation for athletic trainers before the nation had national regulation for athletic trainers. And I'm sure at some point the state exam was at a much harder academic and educational level than the national exam. And at some point the national exam started to creep up, and you had people in the country weighing in. And so, you know, the debate now exists, okay, well, as a licensed athletic trainer versus a nationally certified athletic trainer, what does that do to the brand? And how does that help or hurt the brand? The other public perception is, okay, yeah, you know, if I call him a student athletic trainer, if I call him a student trainer, if I call him a student aide, does it really detract from what it is that they're doing? Versus how does that help or hurt the brand? And so the public perception is, let's say that somebody presents themselves as, you know, I'm a student athletic trainer, and you're at a high school, or that you're at a, you know, state licensed program. You're not at a nationally accredited program. The public perception of that is, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, a 15-year-old can do the job of an athletic trainer. And so to be able to separate that and say, okay, well, if I look at other like professions that are now at the graduate level, right, we don't see people that are interested in physical therapy that are volunteering or working in a PT clinic say, I'm a student physical therapist. They're not. They have to be admitted to an accredited PT program. Same with OT, same with chiropractor, same with medical school. Let's say you have a kid that wants to be a physician that is volunteering in a physician's office or is working in a physician or a hospital. You don't hear them say, well, I'm a medical student. They had to be accepted into that program. So this obviously is another debate.
Definitely.
For another time. And I'm happy to come back. And that's the greatest thing, right? We can be on two different sides of the same issue.
And I can always be correct.
Yeah. Well. I mean, as wrong as you are, you're perfectly entitled to your own opinion. I mean, I'll let you have that, but I mean, you are, you couldn't be more in left field. Yeah. But that's fine. That's fine. Another time.
All right. Well, on that note, I think, is there anything else you had about professional development? I mean, like I said with Shannon, I mean, I think it was really like the last 3 years that I've actually become an athletic trainer rather than doing a job. Mm-hmm. And I think Twitter has been a big part of that, but maybe maturity. And, you know, I definitely feel since I've interacted with you guys, you and Dr. Knobloch, that I'm pushing a little harder to learn more. And, you know, you're talking about, I've talked about wanting to take the
BOC exam
again to regain that. And, you know, you're encouraging me to do it and to study and, you know.
Yeah, you did it once. Yeah, I mean, you already had that credential. You did it once and it just lapsed. And so now you have to go take it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've already been there once. Go do it again. You'll do it.
So, I mean, I'm really glad. Like, I love doing this podcast because I feel it professionally develops me.
Sure.
Whenever I talk to those people. And so, you know, hopefully we're sharing that with other people. You know, people are enjoying it. And I know it's coming up on the 1 year anniversary of the stats that I've been using on the website. And there's been over 15,000 downloads.
Wow.
Just in the course of that year. And so, you know, it's pretty cool for me. I'm not expecting to be some superstar where I get 1 million downloads a month or something. Maybe.
That'd be nice. I mean, instead of me driving from UH, you can send the helicopter. That'd be great.
Exactly. So again, I definitely want to thank you and Dr. Knobloch for coming out, for being part of this.
Yeah, man. This is a great opportunity for us too. And for all those that are interested in the Master of Athletic Training program at the University of Houston, you can hit us up at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. I know we're on Twitter. I don't remember.
U of H M A T.
And we're also on Facebook, Master of Athletic Training at University of Houston. So, Jeremy, thank you for everything. This opportunity has been great for us. Thanks.
All right. So if you want to check out our website, I do have a link in pretty much every episode in the show note, in the notes there, to the Master's of Athletic Training program. So you can click on that and find there. So on my website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, on the homepage, there's the live stream, and that's just if you're watching, which my wife usually does, and then my boys are sitting there talking to the TV while we're having a conversation, so talking to me. So that's for people that want to just watch. So if you want to earn CEUs, you have to register. So it says it at the top of that. It says CEU live event on one of the tabs. Click on there, register, and then you'll be logged in. You have to click the link on your email that it sends you to for it to register as you're signed in, because it keeps track of the time that you're logged in. And that way, if there's a question of whether or not you did that when you reported to the BOC, then I can say, yes, I have it right here recorded as their time. So make sure you log in if you're wanting the CEUs. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's PHS SportsMed. So it's at PHS SportsMed on Twitter, Google Plus Sports Medicine Broadcast, Facebook.com/PHS Athletic Training for Jeremy, Dr. Yellen, the rest of the sports medicine crew.
Yep. Before you sign off one more time, I told my kids that I was going to be on the show today. And my daughter said, she's not feeling well today, so she's at home. She said, will you mention my name? So Rebecca Yellen, Daddy loves you very much.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, sign off.
All right. So for Jeremy, Dr. Yellen, Rebecca Yellen, who is loved by her daddy, my boys, my wife, everybody else listening, for Shannon Lefwich from the BOC, and since we've severely digressed from what we're supposed to be doing, that's a wrap.
All right. Bye.